We have helped hundreds on the path to work optional, and we see the same mistakes over and over again. So we are going to go through the top 9 mistakes we see so they can finally stop costing you. Welcome back to the Becoming Work Optional podcast, where we discuss personal finance strategies you can use to regain ownership of your time. I'm Rachel, and with me is co-host Matt. Hey, Matt.
How's it going?
Today, we're talking about money mistakes. So the bad news here is if you are making these mistakes, some of them are really, really expensive and will cost you. But on the flip side, the good news is a lot of them are actually pretty avoidable. And we're going to talk through the mistakes, how you can avoid them. So going forward, they can stop costing you. So I think we can dive right in. We have 9 mistakes here that we're going to go through. So these are 9 of the most common ones. Matt and I just sat down and kind of discussed and figured out what are the mistakes we see over and over again. And so surprisingly, we see these mistakes across the board for a lot of different types of clients, high net worth, equity compensation, business owners. It's just the same thing over and over again. So I think we're excited to dive in and talk through each of these.
Yeah. So I also don't think that it's a coincidence that probably like our first, 10 episodes or so have covered a lot of these, especially the first mistake we're talking about, like misallocated savings, like, you know, really establishing what your goals are and then putting a time frame on them so that you can have like the cash flow plan, the investment plan. And that's one of the biggest things that we'll see is one or the other, too much cash or not enough cash. So not enough cash, you know, you don't have an emergency fund in place. Too much cash, and this kind of ties into one later about trying to time the market, people will sit on cash just because they think it's, you know, not a good time. And they just want to kind of have it there. And we see this in young, like very young professionals too. You know, they're sitting on the cash, they're, and it might not even be in like a high yield savings account. So mm-hmm. they're not really earning anything. And those are just kind of like little moves that really add up, especially if you're young, you know, having that money invested, it, you know, there isn't really a specific time. You don't need to worry about the timing of when you get in the market. You need to worry about the time that you're in the market overall. So, yeah. Investing, like matching your kind of goals with your investment risk is a huge one.
Yeah. So Matt, I'm curious because, so this mistake number one, just to give a summary, is we're talking about misallocated savings. And a big one we see is like cash and not having the right amount of cash. Something I've noticed is most people are skewing to too much cash lately. And I think that speaks to the interest rate people are getting in high yield savings accounts. So they feel more comfortable keeping a lot in cash. Now, we're going to touch on market timing more in a minute here, but what's important to know is that long-term money does not belong in your cash. If you have some of your cash and it's for retirement, if it's for a work optional goal, if it's for, you know, anything that's decades away, it shouldn't be in cash. We should not commingle that. So with cash, we need to figure out how much you need. So Matt, you pointed this out, but emergency funds, everyone needs that. And the amount of your emergency fund is going to vary by person. So, you know, 3 months, if you're single, don't have dependents, have a stable job, you might get away with a 3-month emergency fund. And then it increases, you know, if you're a single income household, but you have dependents, you have a non-working spouse, maybe an unstable job, then we're going to go to 6+ months of an emergency fund. Now, after that, we're going to look at short, medium-term goals. So any goals where you have you need the money within a few years or a few months, we don't want to invest that. That's way too risky. We want to keep that in cash. So you have your emergency fund figured out. You have your savings figured out for the next few years. And then we've got to get the excess invested in some capacity. It's the interest rate should not be a reason that you're keeping a ton in cash. It should be your goals that relates to cash.
Right. And I think that it goes back to, I was just having this conversation the other day with an old colleague, because we were coming up with like an option strategy. And as much of options are like the kind of like the thesis behind them and everything, it has to do with quantitative aspects. where we had to start was really like how much upside the client wanted to give up for downside protection. So it really does start with the qualitative side of things more than anything. And that especially applies to your cash, your goals, and just making sure that you recognize the opportunity cost. Because yes, 5% in a high yield savings account today sounds like awesome, but like that's not going to be compounding for decades like your long-term investments would be.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, that's mistake number one, misallocated savings. And the big one there is just making sure you get the cash correct. Mistake number two, I see this one is scary amounts. This is poor risk management. Another way of saying it is just not enough insurance. And Matt, I think you can relate, but most people are underinsured. When we go through their financial plan, when we see their insurance coverage, we assume if you're an employee that our employer's taking care of a lot of it, but you really have to check into those policies to make sure that it is adequate coverage and that it's covering you in the way that you want it to. So, life insurance is a big one. We're a fan of term life most of the time, and that's going to cover, your dependents, your spouse, if something were to happen to you. But the one that I see constantly missing or just not enough of is disability insurance. The likelihood of you becoming disabled is much higher than you dying prematurely. We dive really deep into this into our insurance episode. So if this is striking a chord, I'd really encourage you to go to that episode and give it a listen. That is episode 7. So if you want to dive deeper into insurance, definitely go check out that episode. But Matt, I'm curious, do you see this a lot too with a lack of disability insurance with your clients?
Oh, 100%. And especially working with high earners, I'd probably say 90% of the time, like your employer coverage isn't going to be enough to really ensure like your income. Just to give an example, so I have one client where, his income could range anywhere between like $500,000 to $700,000 a year. I'm reviewing his employee handbook. Like he has the short and long term disability. Which was great. But the thing is, when you're looking at it, so like a lot of these policies are going to have provisions where it's like, where there's caps for one. So it's like a monthly cap on the benefit that you can receive from the policy. But you like it might last for 90 days at like your full income. And then after that, it switches over to the long-term policy and it's only a fraction for, it can be laddered out over different time frames. So, it's these policies can be complicated, and the reason that I say that is people will just say like, yeah, I opted into my employer's disability coverage, but they won't know like the coverage amount or any of the provisions of it, whether it's after tax or pre-tax, which is a huge consideration. So all these things really play into like what your risk management strategy looks like. I think that we definitely focus on life insurance and disability insurance a lot because those are kind of the ones that we can really get into like the details for clients and give them advice on. But it applies to everything, especially like high net worth individuals looking at umbrella insurance, making sure that you have the proper coverages and like the underlying liability limits on your property and casualty policies. And these are all things that like, it's a maybe a one in a million event, but like in that one in a million event, like you want to have the proper coverage. You don't want to have been paying into a policy for years, so then when you need it, it doesn't end up actually giving you any of the benefit that you were hoping for.
Umbrella insurance especially is one of those that I think is such a no-brainer a lot of the time. Once your net worth reaches a certain point or your earnings reach a certain point, you want to protect them. And a lot of people don't know that your auto, your home, there's a cap for liability coverage. And what umbrella is going to do is go beyond that cap and give you additional protection. And you can get like $1 million in coverage for really cheap. I just renewed mine, $288 for the year. That's a no-brainer. I'm going to do that every year. And I had somebody who came to me who, before they were my client, they actually went through this where they had homeowners insurance. Somebody came to their home, got injured, their homeowners liability capped, and the rest came from their assets. And they didn't have umbrella at the time. This person now has umbrella and they're going to have umbrella every single year. But this just happens because not enough people know about it. But it's a low-hanging fruit for insurance coverage to get that umbrella. The next thing, the next mistake, we alluded to this, and I think some people aren't going to realize how many of them are doing it, because I see this all the time, and this is market timing. And so I see a lot of people who will say in the same breath, I don't believe in market timing. I don't do it. But I have some cash on the side and I'm waiting to get in because the market seems really high, or it's at all time highs, and I'm just waiting for a pullback. I'm waiting for a good deal. That is market timing. If you have cash sitting on the sidelines, you're waiting to get in, you are timing the market. And this is a really dangerous strategy to employ. There's a lot of graphs out there. We'll have to share one in the show notes, but that shows how much your return is impacted by just missing the five best days in the market. And it's like cut in half over a 20-year period. So I don't think people realize how much of their return comes from just like a few good days in the market. So my fear, and this is what I hope everybody else has too, is being out of the market on one of those good days. This is why market timing is so dangerous, is because you might miss a really good market day that will impact your return.
Yeah. And that's, you know, goes back to, as we said, getting like the cash allocation correct so you could come up with the investment plan. Because if you know that you have your short-term cash needs taken care of, you should be indifferent about your entry mm-hmm. point into the market. You should be like, I know that I'm not going to touch these for 10 plus years. I'm going to get in and just let compounding do its thing.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the worst thing that you can do is rob your portfolio of extra compounding.
Yeah.
But that's not to say that you should jump in with everything that you have, because, you know, you want to make sure every dollar that you have is compounding. You want to make sure every dollar that you don't need in the short term is compounding.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. So market timing comes in, I feel like, a lot of different forms. Like you said, you know, we can kind of talk ourselves around in circles and say like, yeah, I'm not market timing. And then, you know, you get maybe a second opinion, or you really get someone who's actually willing to push back on you, and you realize like, you know, I said that I was going to get in the market like 2 years ago or something. I was waiting for mm-hmm. a good point then. And like, we see this all the time. Like, these aren't exaggerations. Like, this is like real life situations where we see where people are like, yeah, I said I was going to, you know, or I got out at a certain point, said I was going to get back in. And then, you know, years go by and they miss out on huge growth. So last thing you want to do is be sitting on cash that is actually, you know, earmarked for the long term.
Mm-hmm.
And that flows into just investment strategy in general. And this ties into mistake number four, which is, you know, speculating in the market or trying to jump on investment trends. So, you know, when you don't have a plan for, you know, I'm going to contribute this much to my retirement account, this much to my taxable account, like, here's what these are for. Mm-hmm. That's when you're going to get caught up in the news cycles, and you're going to get caught up in, you know, the hot meme stock or whatever it is, and say like, oh, you know, I have this cash sitting here, so let me jump on this, instead of really like having a purpose for it.
Yeah. You know, it's really funny. I was listening to a podcast yesterday. It's My First Million. It's a really big podcast, and it had Sahil Bloom, Nick Bear on it, Sahil Bloom's like big on Twitter. He's an ex-baseball player. So if you're on Twitter, you probably know him. But it's funny because he was talking about in this message, group chat that he's in, there's all these different guys, they're big entrepreneurs, and they're constantly talking about investment trends and jumping on them. And he's like, inevitably, within 6 months after they're talking about this, it hits an all-time low. So it never works out for them. He's like, at one point when I was younger, I was kind of into that. And now I'm just primarily boring index funds, you know. And this is a big entrepreneur, somebody who was in private equity. And he's done with speculation and jumping on investment trends to a certain extent. I think a lot of people find it exciting and thrilling. But it, in all honesty, when you adopt it as somebody who needs this money and your goal is to become work optional, it can actually become really dangerous. I think a lot of these guys who talk about some of these investment trends and they were jumping on things like aluminum or whatever was hot at the time, I think people have to realize they're doing it with a really small percentage of their money, and that's how they're being safe there. When you hear about this, it's important to recognize that a lot of these people, not all of them, but a lot of them, the majority of their wealth is in boring index funds or in their business. So you have to be careful when you hear about like these hot investment trends or speculation. And when we say speculation, it's honestly things like individual stock picking. Crypto is still speculative. Anything that really hasn't, you know, proven itself or it has a high risk of going to zero. So a question I ask, and I actually had a client who close to retirement, very smart guy, investment analyst, and he's really into crypto. And the question I asked this person was, do you want to make another $1 million or do you want to retire? And he said, I want to retire. I want to know that I can retire. And he liked that question. He used it when he was out to dinner with his friends and they were talking about crypto, because we have to define the goal here. Yes, we can keep swinging big and shooting, you know, for the moon, but there is a downside. And I see it as unnecessary a lot of times to have this risk in the portfolio. I don't want a downside to exist for somebody who wants to become work optional or who wants to enter retirement, where you can run out of money due to this investment, due to holding too much of it. I like to eliminate that risk. And a way that we eliminate it is to bring a speculation down to a small percentage of your portfolio, like 5% or less. Some people go a little higher, 10%, but really, to eliminate the risk, I like to see it as a really small percentage of your portfolio and just ask yourself, what's my goal here? Am I trying to swing for the fences, become a multimillionaire, but also risk going to zero? Or do I just want to retire or become work optional or you know, be able to switch over to entrepreneurship? I think for most of us, we'd realize that the risk is not worth it for a lot of these speculative investments.
Yeah. And I think it's like, I don't know if I'm even using the right term, but like the law of diminishing returns, in the sense of like, if you made an extra $1 million, like what would be the material impact on your life? Like, would there be, or would a more material impact be if you lost $1 million? That would really throw everything off. So really having like, and I said this the other day, like you really need to have a thesis of like why you are getting into an investment. Is it because you have like knowledge of the industry, or was it pitched to you as a potential way to make a score? So those are the things that like you really have to have. Like, also the other thing, having an exit point, like predetermined when you get into something, knowing like, okay, if this event happens, like this macro event, or if it hits a certain price, like I'll have made this much. Like really knowing when, or like having a predetermined exit point instead of continuing to ride it and be like, oh, well, like now I can squeeze a little bit more out of it. You know, you have to think through these things before you make an investment, instead of just like hearing someone mention something on a podcast or, in passing, and then being like, yeah, I'm going to throw, you know, money that could really be going towards like your work optional goals or anything else that you have, you know, throwing money towards that. Instead of like an actual investment plan.
Yeah. I went on a rant with active stock picking last episode, so I'll try to refrain myself. But mistake number five, let's go into the next one. This is delayed or no tax planning. And we see people get this confused all the time. They think, you know, they go to their accountant around April, or if you extend your taxes, maybe later, and they file and they think, okay, well, that's tax planning. Tax planning really starts the beginning of the year. You need to have a plan for the year, because a lot of tax planning has to be completed by December 31st. So once you get around to filing your taxes for last year, a lot of the strategies we can use, it's too late for. So you really have to be proactive. And this is something, you know, Matt and I do for our clients all the time, but creating a proactive strategy for the year to optimize taxes. Optimizing taxes looks very different for everyone. It depends on if you're, you know, an employee with equity compensation or a business owner, just W-2, normal payroll. But the point is, you have to understand what's available to you from a tax optimization standpoint. And a lot of people don't know this. And then figure out how you're going to take advantage of it throughout the year.
Yeah. And that, you mentioned like me working a lot with equity comp. That is like, there's always tax planning to look at, because it's like, you know, how much room do we have to exercise incentive stock options up to like the AMT threshold? And like, just so many things around exercise. And then like, if you have millions, like a lot of executives have really high income, then they have RSUs vesting and they're withheld at a lower rate than they're taxed at. And then they end up with this huge tax bill that they weren't expecting. Like, this is stuff that happens all the time. And that's why tax planning, like, really, I think I'd probably hit on it. It, like, for ongoing clients that we like have our cadence, we probably touch on it every meeting, but like really focus on it at least two meetings out of the whole year to really like get a plan kind of in place, a preliminary plan in the beginning of the year. And then like Q3, Q4, seeing where things are at, and then like doing our charitable contributions, things like, you know, super funding a donor advised fund or something with appreciated stock. Like, there are so many things that you can do when you're proactive with tax planning.
Yeah.
And the other thing too, that I think gets lost in translation a lot, is like, tax planning is not just like paying the least amount of tax in a given year. It's paying the least amount of tax over your lifetime. Sometimes it makes sense to actually pay a little bit more tax and accelerate income in a certain
yes.
year. And these are just, you know, things that you're not going to really think about if you're just getting your 1099s and everything in March and then sending them off to your CPA and being like, you know, work some magic for me.
Yeah. We're going to hit on some of the low hanging fruit for taxes and the last mistake. So mistake number nine, we'll hit on that. But the next mistake also, I think we can do a whole episode on mistake and taxes.
Yeah.
And we'll do a lot of episode with taxes. But mistake number six is ignoring taxes and investing. This is one of the biggest mistakes. And I actually think if you pay attention to this, can have one of the biggest impacts to your wealth. So a lot of people, when they have just a regular brokerage account, they don't realize the tax impact that is happening when they are buying and selling. So, you know, we talked about the risk of speculative investments and stock picking, but we also have to talk about it from the viewpoint of taxes and how it's impacting your taxes. So just to give a brief overview, when we're talking about just a regular brokerage account, you know, you have short-term gains in it and then you have long-term gains. The important thing to know here is that those are taxed differently. Long-term capital gains are taxed at the capital gains rates. That's lower than ordinary income. So for most people, they're in the 15% capital gains rate, while they might be in the, you know, 24% federal tax bracket. So you're getting a discount there for holding investments for the long term. You lose that when you are buying and selling stocks or buying and selling whatever it is in a regular brokerage account. Now, this doesn't apply to retirement accounts. I have to give that disclosure. You could buy and sell all day long in a retirement account and not have any tax impact. They're both tax deferred accounts. But for your brokerage account, tax efficiency is so important here. And we're just kind of touching the tip of the iceberg. There's a lot of detail that goes into this as far as tax efficient versus tax inefficient investments. A big one to know, though, is to be careful when you're trading in this account.
Right. And you know, that's just like you mentioned, touching on like the holding period of the investments between like short and long term, which I think is something that we'll take for granted, is just like, yeah, people know that, when realistically a lot of people don't.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, like, you know, with tax efficiency, tax location of your investments. So yeah. Like, you know, when we're kind of positioning portfolios, we want to have like the high growth stocks that aren't really like paying any kind of dividends or interest in, well, like either the Roth, like the highest growth in the Roth. And then, but we really want investments that aren't going to be kicking off income in the taxable brokerage account, because that way you're not realizing and being taxed on income that as it comes in, versus, you know, if you held all your bonds in a taxable brokerage account and they're continuing to kick off interest for you, like, that's taxable to you every year. So these are things that, you know, you're probably just not going to realize because you're just like, yeah, you're paying your taxes when you file and it is what it is. But, you know, over the course of your lifetime, like, if you're investing, you know, if you were hitting everything else right, like you had a really good investment plan, and you were just missing the tax location and tax efficiency of investing, you could cost yourself thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars.
A lot. Yeah. Yep. We touch on this episode 3. So if you want to know more about taxes, you can check out that episode. We'll have to do one just dedicated to brokerage account investing, because that one, I mean, we could talk about that for a long time. Mistake number 7, not creating or updating your estate plan. Again, just something. I mean, honestly, guys, these are real life mistakes we see constantly. We're not making this up. This one I see all the time. We don't have an estate plan in place, or if we do, it's 10 years old and just is outdated now. It's so important that you are the person who's deciding what happens to your assets if something happens to you. This is a way to protect your family. It's to protect your wishes. And so really shouldn't be taken lightly. If you're overwhelmed and maybe in a place where you can't afford a really expensive estate plan, and not everyone needs an expensive estate plan, there are ways to get, a will and powers of attorneys really affordable online. So definitely look into that. But it's important that you create an estate plan that, mimics your wishes for how your assets are transferred on. But also, number two is to continue to update it and make sure that, if you got divorced, that that's updated. If you have another child, that that's included. We go through all these life changes and then forget to update our estate plan.
Oh yeah, I mean, like life gets in the way. I've been meaning to schedule a doctor's appointment for 2 weeks, and I haven't because I've like just
Same.
been wrapped up with other stuff, and it's just like continues just get pushed down the list until it's completely off your radar, and that's what always happens with estate planning. And then, like you mentioned, like we're seeing these real life situations where someone comes in and their ex-spouse is still the primary beneficiary on their like biggest retirement account. And there's just things like this that are going like those are extreme. Like that would be really bad. But then like, having just basic like healthcare power of attorneys, like financial power of attorneys in place, like you just never know what's gonna happen. It goes back to like you mentioned, the client that had someone get injured on their property. It's like you're never going to appreciate the risk management and like the estate planning until you need it. It's just it's a thankless kind of planning point. I personally love estate planning, especially like with high net worth clients, just because there's so much flexibility. And I think that once they realize everything that they can really like craft from like a legacy perspective as well, they start to really get excited about it. But I can understand how like the basic part of the estate plan can be overlooked for the early years, but it's just something you can't overlook.
And no one wants to think about the situation. No one thinks that it can happen to them. But, I used to work with a lot of retirees, so kind of an older client base. And when estate planning wasn't done, or if it wasn't clear what the wishes of the deceased person was, it gets so messy. You will be so surprised at a family that you thought was, perfectly in sync start to battle, with an estate, and to have conflicting opinions on the person who passed away, what they would want. So it's always important to create the estate plan. Just make it crystal clear too. You can have a document that supplements the estate plan that kind of details your wishes that might not be included in the will or the trust. And though it might not be legally enforceable, it's still good for your family to give them clarity for exactly what you want. Mistake number eight, another one. It kills me to see this one. This is funding a wrong IRA. The one I see surprisingly a lot, and I guess it shouldn't be too surprising. The rules around this are really confusing, but it is making a traditional IRA contribution when it's not deductible. So I don't think a lot of people realize that if you put money into your traditional IRA, there are income limits for if that contribution can be deductible, and it starts pretty low. So, and it depends on if you have access to an employer plan, if your spouse has access to an employer plan. So the income differs quite a bit. But if you have access to a 401k with your work and your spouse does, there's a good chance that you cannot make a deductible IRA contribution. And if you can't make a deductible IRA contribution, then it's kind of pointless to contribute to the traditional IRA at all. I mean, it's just a bad deal at that point compared to taxable brokerage account. So I see a lot of high earners make this mistake because they want to maximize traditional accounts. They want to bring down taxable income, which is understandable, but they don't realize that that contribution to the traditional IRA is not even deductible on their tax return.
Yeah, and like you said, I'll meet with a lot of high earners that are like super focused on bringing down their taxable income, but then it's like, maybe they're contributing like $18,000 to their traditional 401k instead of like the max, but then they're like, oh, well, I'm doing the traditional IRA contribution. I'm like, that doesn't matter. You're not getting a
Yeah.
deduction for it. So like, let's instead up your traditional 401k contribution to the max. And then, if we can do a backdoor Roth strategy, let's do it. But I'm with you. If you can, like, if you have a bunch of money in a traditional IRA and for whatever reason you can't roll it into like an employer sponsored 401k, I would rather have those savings go to a taxable brokerage account from
Yeah.
a flexibility standpoint and the long-term capital gains standpoint. But then if you are making backdoor Roth IRA contributions, which there's, other things that you need to consider here between like the pro rata and the aggregation rule. I don't know if we necessarily need to get into that, but just know that if you are seeing like someone talk about a backdoor Roth IRA online, don't just go and do it because you said, like they said, it's a good idea. Like you need to make sure that you are hitting all the like different variables that's, apply to the situation as well as documenting it on your tax return. But that's like from a mistake. I think that's probably like maybe the biggest mistake I see like all the time is either the non-deductible IRA contributions, or making ineligible Roth, like direct Roth IRA contributions. And then last one is going back to what I mentioned on the, I forget which mistake it was, but I'll have like someone will be making like for like when I first was starting off with clients, like they were in a low tax bracket, but they're like they wanted the deduction on the traditional IRA contribution so bad. But like at that stage, your best bet is to actually do the Roth IRA contribution because then you can get all the tax-free growth in. But it's gonna apply to everyone's situation differently. And that's why it always helps to have either a second set of eyes or for you to really dig in to see which one is best for you.
That's actually our next episode, traditional versus Roth. I can't wait to dive into that. Most people get this wrong. I see a lot of people get it wrong, and there's a way to optimize it. So next episode, we'll dive a lot deeper into that. Okay, final mistake number nine. This is kind of a really actionable one, but this is not taking advantage of low-hanging fruit. So this is just a lot of the things that we see that if you just made a slight tweak, could really impact your finances. Going back to the first mistake with cash, something we see a lot is that people will have money in a savings account and it'll be getting like 0.01%. And yes, don't keep too much cash, but for the cash you do keep, make sure you're getting a decent interest rate. So high yield savings accounts have decent interest rates right now. Actually had a client who needed to keep $1 million in cash and didn't realize by just transferring that money from a savings account getting 0.01% to a savings account getting 5%, that was an extra 50 grand that we just kind of found just by transferring that account over. And they didn't realize that that was the type of impact it can have. Sometimes you have to translate that savings percentage into a dollar amount to really get it.
Oh, 100%. I love putting things in dollar perspective, like dollar amounts, because that's what really gets people to take action. But yeah, I mean, like just the low-hanging fruit from like employer benefits standpoint, like
That's a big
employer
one.
benefits usually make up like almost a third of your like total compensation. But like it's not something that just happens. Like you have to really like look through your employee benefit handbook and see, what's available to you and make sure you're enrolling in them because some things are going to be like really discounted, some things are going to be paid for completely by the employer. And then just like from an investment standpoint, making sure you're using low cost funds, and like you're not just making moves that are going to generate excess tax. So those are things, when we a lot of people like to say like, oh, how can an advisor like add value and stuff? It's like simply by pointing out things like this that you're not paying attention to, a lot of the times can justify the fee that I charge. And that's why I always feel confident not only with those things, but then once we really get into the deep planning, that's where there's so much value to be had. But most people, I always like to start with just like basic stuff like this because 9 times out of 10, it's getting missed.
So with the employee benefits, you have the healthcare accounts, you have the HSA, which we talk about all the time. triple tax advantage accounts. So can make a huge impact, especially in retirement when health costs, you know, really skyrocket for some people. The FSA is a flexible spending account. It can be used for healthcare. It also can be used for dependent care. So I have some clients who were spending a lot of money on daycare and, you know, it's for, so they were able to work. And just by funneling, you know, $5,000 through the dependent care FSA first, you're able to use $5,000 pre-tax to spend on dependent care. So you're in the highest tax bracket, 37%, you know, that's almost $2,000 that you're saving just by funneling it through the FSA first. For some people, maybe that's not enough to be compelling, but for other people who want to take that almost $2,000, go on vacation or buy something or use it for their work optional goal, that's money that you just got by funneling it through a certain type of account first.
Yeah. And you're never going to really be able to weigh the impact of, like, it's one thing to have like a tangible, like $2,000 in that year. It's another thing when you start to think about that, like when these mistakes are repeated over decades.
Yeah.
And how the, like, those savings could either be invested or go towards you literally just enjoying your life. Those are the things that I feel like it's really hard for us to grasp, that, but that's, those are the kind of context you have to think in to really get yourself to make or take action.
Yeah.
But I think that's all the mistakes we had. That brings us to the end of the episode. You know, really hope that this kind of points things out for you, helps you to, if you're making these mistakes, stop them and really like save yourself money going forward. As always, thanks for listening. You know, if you enjoy the show, please consider rating wherever you're watching or listening. Come back next time on our discussion on traditional versus Roth. As Rachel mentioned, so many considerations that people just really don't talk about. And I think that it's going to be a really interesting episode.
I'm so excited for that episode.
and you can find me on Twitter, Instagram, pretty much any social platform at Matthew_Garrisick, and my business website, unrivaledwm.com.
You can find me at Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, most places I'm Camp Wealth. Twitter, I'm Camp_Wealth. And then my business website is rachelcampwealth.com.
Awesome. Thanks, Rachel. See you guys next time.
Thanks. This content is strictly for educational and informational purposes. And because everyone's situation is unique, you should consult with the appropriate professional before enacting any of the information you may hear in this podcast. You should not construe any such information or material as legal, tax, investment, or financial advice. This content is provided as is, and although the material is believed to be accurate, no representations are made that the content is error-free.